So before I start, I should take just a sec to thank Andy for giving me the opportunity to talk and thank him for a couple pretty pictures that you'll see, the first one shown here. This is one of the mobile units they use in their phenotyping work in Maricopa. And I'm going to talk about IR measurements in phenotyping applications. You can see the IR sensors here on the front of it. My outline is really simple. I'm going to talk about principles and applications, mostly the principles. Motivation being, I work for Apogee Instruments, a company that produces infrared sensors. And we heard earlier from Bob Reginato and Andy French and Bruce Kimball, the water lab is one of some of the pioneering work in infrared measurements in environmental and agricultural applications. So people have been making IR measurements for decades, not a new thing. But putting them on mobile platforms like you see here and making high frequency measurements is a relatively new thing. And at Apogee, we get lots of questions about how to do this. So I'll focus more on the principles and get to the applications towards the end. And I'll start out by talking just a bit about calibration. This picture actually takes you inside the calibration device that we use at Apogee Instruments, and it's a two-component unit. There's a black body cone, and you'll get a better look at that in just a second. And then thermally isolated from the black body cone, there's this piece that holds all of the sensors. And each component, the part where the sensors are housed and the black body cone, are thermally isolated, and they're covered with Peltier coolers, heat sinks, and fans, so we can independently control the temperature of the cone and the sensor bodies themselves. Here's a look inside the black body. Now the cap piece with all the sensors in it is removed. But the real points that I want to make with regards to calibration are twofold. One, the calibration range of target temperatures should at least match the range of temperatures you expect to measure in the field. And the second point is, at each calibration set point, data should be collected over a wide range of temperature differences between the target and the detector. The main reason being, the detectors aren't perfectly linear, and they also have temperature sensitivity. And so we need to account for both of those things in calibration in order to make accurate measurements in the field. So the signal from these sensors is typically an analog signal, a voltage that's dependent on the radiation absorbed by the detector and the radiation emitted by the detector. And so it's a net signal, and they're quite small. I've given an approximate range here, 20 to 60 microvolts per degree C difference between the detector and target. What this really means is, independent of how accurately the sensor is calibrated, you need to have a high resolution and a high accuracy voltmeter in order to make the measurement. So you can't just buy a high-end sensor that's well calibrated and expect to plug it into anything and get good data. Another point that I will make here is there are some digital models available where the company actually builds the A to D converter into the sensor. But one of the potential challenges with this is the communications take time, whereas analog measurements tend to be a bit faster. And so depending on the digital communications protocol, it might slow it down to the point where it doesn't work for a mobile platform. So related to that, I want to talk a bit about the speed of measurements. Here you're looking at some data that just show the response to a step change in temperature as a function of time. And there are two different data sets. This is just two different models of infrared sensor. We typically define the time constant as the time it takes to respond to 63% of the new signal, and the response time is the time it takes to respond 95% of the way to the new signal. The point that I want to make here is the measurement frequency, or the speed at which you're collecting data on your mobile platform, should be based on the radiometer response time. Otherwise, essentially what you're getting, if you're measuring faster than the sensor can respond, you're essentially going to be averaging the previous measurement with the new measurement. And I bring that up because I've seen this before, and I'll make a point in just a second. And people ask us all the time, well, if this is the case and I want to measure fast, can't you just build a faster response sensor? And the answer is absolutely, but it comes at a trade-off. So the two data sets that you see here are radiometers that we build at Apogee. The blue one is much faster than the red one, but the signals are also much smaller. So we've built a sensor that's about 3 times faster, and what you get is signals that are about 3 times smaller. So again, it highlights the importance of a high-resolution device in order to make these measurements accurately. So recently I was at a phenotyping conference in Australia, and I listened to a presentation where they were measuring the sensor that has the red data there at 10 hertz. And what you get is it's only about 40% of the way, or the response is only about 40% of the new signal. It's essentially, it's 10 hertz data using this red sensor here would be an average of the previous measurement and the new measurement. Okay, so the next principle I want to talk just a bit about is the footprint, or the actual area on the ground that you sense with the radiometer. And it depends on 3 things, the field of view of the instrument itself, the mounting height, and the mounting angle. This question, I think, probably comes up more than any other. I mean, just last night at the opening social, I was spending time in the Apogee booth, and 2 or 3 people came by and said, if I want to measure plant temperature with this thing, where do I put the radiometer? How high above the plant? And the answer to that question is, well, what do you want to measure on the ground? Are you interested in a spot this big or this big? Because the field of view of the radiometer can be adjusted. There's different models out there with different fields of view. You can change the angle at which it's mounted, or you can move it up and down. So you really have to ask the question, what do you want to see on the ground? And that will determine where you put the sensor and what type of field of view it has. So just as an example, let's say this circle here represents the footprint that we're measuring. And if we go along a crop row where the plants are changing in size, you might have a situation where the plant temperature is constant along the row, but because the composition of the field of view is changing significantly, you might have measured infrared temperatures that are increasing as you go down the row. And so you have to be fully aware of what's within the field of view and account for that in order to make judgments or interpretations of the temperature data. And so one way to try to maximize field of view, or excuse me, canopy within the field of view, might be to angle the radiometer. So what I've shown here is a little picture representative of potentially a situation like this. But if you angle the radiometer, you can now try to eliminate some of the soil within the background to maximize more canopy within the field of view. And just to give you an idea, I did some simple model calculations. What's shown here is the difference between the measured or radiometric temperature and the actual canopy temperature as a function of leaf area index for 2 different radiometer mounting angles. And you can see as you get more leaf area, those 2 temperatures get much closer. And as you start to angle the radiometer off nadir, so more of an oblique view, the temperatures, the radiometric measured temperature and the actual canopy temperature get closer. So the last principle that I'll cover is emissivity correction. Emissivity is the fraction of black body emittance, and black bodies, of course, are objects or materials that emit the theoretical maximum amount of radiation given their temperature. So if we have a surface with an emissivity of 1 that's a perfect black body, then radiation from the surface is the only radiation stream that's incident on the detector. But in practice, natural surfaces are not black bodies. Often they have emissivities just a little bit below 1. In this example, we'll assume our plant canopy has an emissivity of 0.98. What that means is most of the radiation incident on the detector is coming from the surface, but there's a small reflected component that comes from the background. And in an outdoor application, the background is the sky. Well, unless it's overcast or very, very cloudy, there's a large temperature difference between the sky and the surface that you're sensing. And so even though you have this small fraction, it would be 0.02 in this case, of radiation that gets reflected from the background, because it's so cold, it reduces the measured temperature below the actual temperature. And so in order to account for this, we have to do an emissivity correction. The equation is relatively simple, but we need 3 pieces of information in order to do it. 1 is the measured temperature. The other is some estimate or measurement of the background temperature. And the third is some idea of the surface emissivity. So to give you an idea of how much this matters, again, I did some simple model calculations. And what you're looking at here is the measured temperature and the surface temperature difference. So the surface would be the actual surface temperature, and the measured temperature is what the radiometer is giving you. And I'm plotting them as a function of cloudiness. I apologize that label got cut off there, but what you're looking at on the x-axis is a ratio of actual solar radiation that you would measure, say, with a pyranometer to a theoretical clear sky solar radiation value. And so one would represent a perfectly clear sky, and as you get smaller numbers, it's just increasing in cloudiness. So you can see the temperature from our device is quite a bit colder than the actual surface temperature when it's clear, and as it gets cloudier, those two get closer together. So in order to get a true surface temperature, we have to do an emissivity correction. Otherwise, we're only looking at relative numbers. So now I'll transition for just a sec with the time that I have left and talk about what to do with the data or the application of temperature data. I'm only going to talk about one variable that we can potentially estimate, and that's the model conductance. John Norman, Bruce Bugbee, and myself published a paper a few years ago now where we were making stationary measurements of infrared surface temperature and coupling them with the other standard weather variables from a weather station. And we're using those data to estimate canopy stomatal conductance in different crop canopies. Here what you see is corn, but we did it for cotton and rice and alfalfa and other crops. I won't spend much time on this slide, but essentially what we're doing is taking the surface energy balance, which is all the components are shown in the figure, separating it into the soil and canopy components, and then solving the canopy energy balance for this conductance term here. Alternatively, you could look at transpiration if you wanted to. So the method requires standard weather variables in addition to the canopy temperature. Then you need some information about the canopy height and leaf area index in order to get to stomatal conductance. And fortuitously, in a lot of phenotyping applications, two of the plant variables that we're interested in measuring or estimating are height and leaf area index. So here's just some data to give you an idea of how well the model works. This is for a cotton canopy, and this is a stationary application. What you're looking at is the green points are actual stomatal conductance values predicted from the equations I just showed you, and the black lines are theoretical maximum values, or what we would call potential stomatal conductance, that come from a scaled-up-leaf model. You can see before this irrigation event, the green points don't match the maximum very well. It's water stress, and after the irrigation event, the green data match quite well. And we've alleviated the water stress by irrigating. It's just some data to give you an idea of how it works. So I tried this back to Andy's picture and the sensing platform here in Maricopa. I'm just going to show you a really brief snapshot of some of the data. Here are the raw data from the sensor, so the measured temperatures for just a few points along a row that's well watered and a row where there's water deficit. And the data processed through the model to show stomatal conductance. So the data indicate, as long as the weather measurements are relatively stable, you can use the temperature measurements to estimate something that's closer to a plant phenotype of stomatal conductance. Looks like I'm about out of time, so I will just show you the summary slide and stop there. Thank you. Yeah, Jeff. Yeah.
Mark, do you have any comments on the relative value of the thermometry as opposed to the infrared images from a FLIR?
So I actually think that FLIR cameras, or doesn't necessarily have to be the FLIR brand, but any IR camera has potential to be very powerful because you get a lot of spatial information really quickly that are not as easy to obtain with a system like this. But there are trade-offs, as there tend to be in everything, and those are that The FLIR instruments tend to be quite expensive, and typically the accuracy isn't as good as you can get with something like this. So I'm not, we don't make imagers at Apogee, and I'm not an expert, but we do have a low-end FLIR device, and I think the calibration specification that comes with the device that we own at Apogee is like plus or minus 2 Celsius, whereas the calibration that I explained earlier for our sensors is plus or minus 0.2 Celsius. And that doesn't mean you can't do your own field calibrations of the FLIR type devices and improve them. People do this all the time, but it's a bit trickier to get higher accuracy data with the imagers.
Thank you.